Pushkin. Glenn Hansard is best known as the lead in the 2007 movie Once. It's about a hardscrabble busker in Dublin. It's a role he was probably destined to play, himself having dropped out of school at 13 to busk around Ireland's capital. Prior to that movie role, Hansard had put out a string of great albums with a band called The Frames. But after the film, he started working on other projects and also a solo career. Sliding along by the sand, it's mayday, the salt in my head once again. It's a long way down to the bottom we've been racing. His fourth solo album, The Wild Willing, came out on Anti Records last year. He and his band, including keyboardist Rami, met up with Bruce Headlam in Nashville to chat about the unique approach he and the band took to creating the record, improvising nearly every song. And unlike most folk records, it has a lot of electronics on it, like Race to the Bottom, the song we're hearing now. Hansard talks and plays through some of the songs off the album, and then opens things up with a song that contains a very unintuitive sample. This is Broken Record, liner notes for the digital age. I'm Justin Richmond. Here's Glenn Hansard playing I'll Be You, Be Me. See if you can guess the sample.
very hard to sum up your career because you've done so many different things. And when I was reviewing them, I realized something, and I don't know if this has occurred to you, but you won an Oscar for the song from the movie Once. And I think you won a Grammy as well for that.
I know the soundtrack won a Grammy. I don't know. Does that mean I did?
I think it means you did.
Oh, maybe it didn't. I think the... No, I think... Yeah, it did. Yeah.
Okay. And then it once became a Broadway show that won a slew of Grammys.
Tonys and Grammys.
Tonys,
yeah.
Pardon me.
Yeah,
Tonys. Yeah, yeah. But that means you have an Oscar, a Grammy, and a Tony. Mm. If you get an Emmy, you have the EGOT. Do you know the EGOT?
No.
The EGOT is for people who've won Emmys, Grammys, Oscars, and Tonys.
It's a special award.
There's only been 15 people in history.
No way.
You would join Richard Rodgers, Helen Hayes.
Okay.
John Legend, but, you know, Barbara Streisand didn't do it.
Okay, wow.
So see what you can do, okay?
Okay.
All right. That's our project.
You've given me a new trajectory in life.
Okay. All right. We're on it. That's our project then. TV people, listen up. We're getting this man an EGOT.
You got it.
This album, this is a new album you're releasing, is it's described as a departure from what you've been doing the last few albums. So tell me about the making of this album and how it is different.
Well, sometimes we go through periods of our life where we're doing certain things and we're writing certain ways. And for me, the last couple of records, certainly since the beginning of me making Glenn Hansard records, it seemed to me like the city of New York had a kind of a, there was a through line, there was a kind of an American sense throughout the records that I was making over the last few years. And this one, it's the longest period in the last kind of 20 years that I haven't been in America, which is about a year and a half. And, you know, not to say that that really means anything for or against the record. It's just that I spent a lot of time in Paris in the last year and a half, and also time with Romy and David Odlum over in France recording this record, and Joe making a kind of a, decided to make an acoustic record. But I had some time in France and in Paris, and that I think is what made this album a little different. In that when I listen to these songs now, it's the streets of Paris that come back to me, because it was on the streets where I wrote the lyrics, you know, taking long walks and thinking, meditating. When a song comes into your head, you get about 4 days of absolute focus because you get excited about a lyric or you get excited about a melody, and it just rolls around your head and around your head and around your head. And you can sit and you can write at your desk, or you can just go for walks, because the song's not going to leave your head. Sometimes you've got 4 days, sometimes you've got 2 weeks where the song won't leave your head. You become obsessed. It becomes the only thought you have, and everything else is just is surrounding that one thought. And so in Paris, I was walking around with these songs in my head, and I was finding the lines, and I was kind of jotting them down quickly, either in my phone or in a notebook. And when I'd get home that evening, I'd sort of compile what I'd sort of come across during the day. And what's wonderful, I set a couple of parameters around the songs, in that I thought each lyric needs to be an actual experience. I wanted every line in the album and every line in every song to be a particular memory, that it couldn't just be, oh, that rhymes with that, and that's actually a good line. That wasn't good enough. It had to be, I wanted to anchor every line into something that was actually going on.
Hmm. And the song you just performed, I'll Be You.
Yeah. I remember walking from the Irish Cultural Center, which was the place I was staying. It was like an old monastery, and they gave us a small room. And I was spending time in that place and really loving it, in the Latin Quarter, right in the middle of the Latin Quarter, in the Fifth Arrondissement in Paris. And I was walking down the Rue Mouffetard and turning left. And just as I got to the junction of La Gobeline, which is one of the sort of major streets, this whole thing just sort of hit me. You know, I had kind of hit upon, with Joe and Ruth in the studio, Your Love's a Bonnie Snare, Traps Me in the Evening, which I thought, what an interesting thing to just sort of pop out of your mouth. And I liked the image of it, you know, that there's a kind of a, you know how to pull me in. You know exactly what it is. You know my buttons, you know, and there's an intimacy in that, and admitting to someone that you know exactly what it is. And so I started to think about the song as the lover, as the spider who devours her lover. And so I started going off on that imagery in my head. And it was like, I'll be you, be me, and I'll be you, and we won't say no more about it. This idea that we'll swap, we'll become each other. And I was really, really pleased with where the song was going. It kind of, there was a kind of a permission to get dark, if you like. Mm-hmm. There was something about the chord structure that allowed you to stay between dark and contemplative and even lightness. So for me, when I hear the song, I'm straight back on that street, and it's a particular corner. You know, so I'm very happy with how that turned out, because now when I sing these songs, I can, there's a place in them. I can place myself in somewhere.
Mm-hmm. It's also a song that just technically uses a sample, which, had you ever used a sample before?
Oh, yeah. Oh, we've used samples through the frames. Okay. Yeah, a long time.
Okay.
And my friend David was in the studio, and I had myself and Ruth and Joe start playing around with this, like, it was just like, da, boom. And we were just fooling around, and my friend David Cleary, who I had asked to come over, there's two really interesting musicians from Dublin, David Cleary and Dunk Murphy, who are kind of experimental electronic musicians, and they would very much inhabit the world that Romy inhabits, which is just all about texture and bending, and the only kind of instruction that they were given coming into the record was like, we'd love you to come in because we have a bunch of Persian musicians coming in, mm-hmm. so we'd love you to come in as a balance. Because if it was just Persian musicians playing along with an acoustic record, it's going to sound quite esoteric, maybe world music in a way. So the way to balance that was to bring in these electronic musicians and say, your job is to disrupt the music, just to disrupt anything you hear and come in and just put an elbow into it, a dirty mm-hmm. elbow, which is exactly what they did. And David said, I have a beat for that I think would really work. And the beat was really odd. And it's from a cassette, so it's really noisy. And we kind of fell in love with the texture of the sound because as a beat, it's just a very simple beat. But we fell in love with the texture. And he said, you know, no one will ever know what this is. This is from the David Bowie Queen session for Under Pressure, but it's like a song that was never used. Don't worry about it. It's something I found somewhere that no one will ever figure out what it is.
Right.
You know, and so we got excited by it. And the idea that what we're hearing is, you know, John Deacon, you know, and there's a touch of Bowie in the vocal, you know, there's a kind of a very, very, so just the fact that the spirit of these people is on the song kind of gave it an extra layer of kind of sensuality, if you like. So we got very excited about it. We finished the song, we mixed it, it mastered it, and we put it on a record. And then suddenly, you know, I downloaded Spotify on my computer because I'd been asked to do it so many times just to sort of listen to it and check it out, which I'd kind of resisted up until that point. And so I did. And within six songs of listening to Spotify, I heard a song called Cool Cat by Queen, which it was exactly the same beat. And I realized that we were in real trouble.
What are the chances Queen would sue us over?
Yeah.
exactly. Nobody's heard of them.
Exactly. And we all cursed our friend David for a while, and then Howard had the unenviable job of going and trying to contact Brian May and asking him for permission, which took a couple of months because they had the movie coming out and stuff. So the album ended up getting put back till April. But, you know, in the end of the day, we did recreate the beat, which was easy to do because it's not like a super original beat or anything. It's like a boom, boom, you know, it's on every record. But the fact that it was them, the fact that it was had all that hiss, the fact that it came from that session was worth actually pursuing it. It was worth actually asking and going through the front door and asking for permission. And they gave us permission.
Hmm. Maybe you're listening to a premium lawyer's edition of Spotify that just allows them
that's good.
To track it down. You've said this album was built from the ground up.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
What it means is that not one song on this record was a song before we went into the studio. And that's untrue. The two songs, the one I'll Come Back to Find are Leave a Light and Brother's Keeper were two songs that existed before. But the rest of the songs came in the studio. They were brand new. They were brand new in the studio. And like, for instance, like I'll Be You, Be Me was played once. We never played it twice. It was a little jam that we elaborated on. A song like Weight of the World that happened once, we've never played it since. You know, we've actually tried to play it at sound checks and stuff, but we never managed to figure out what we did in the moment. And that became the exciting part of the birth of this record, was we were going in to record a set of songs. you know, and some of them were covers even. We were going in to record a couple of friends of our songs. And then when it came time to listen back to what we had, we realized that there was a whole bunch of jams that were really interesting. And then we just decided to scrap everything that we were working on and then just focus on the jams. And once we focused on them and we elaborated on them, they became their own songs entirely. And they became much more exciting because they were coming out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. So for instance, I'm singing songs in keys that are not good for my voice. My voice is way down low, but I'm just trying to jam along with whatever chords we just came up with. So there's a kind of an element of freedom to those songs that was much more attractive to us in that moment than the songs that we went in to try nail, if you like.
Why don't we hear another one?
Yeah. This is called Fool's Game. It's a fool's game. Lover that we have to play. Crash into each other. No convalescing. It's a leap of faith. Lover that we blindly take. I'm taking it with you and no other. No hesitating. And if our minds they go, and our bones they shatter, we'll put it on nobody but ourselves. It's an old refrain. Lover that we hear again, urging a cautious measure and sounding a warning. It's a thin escape. Lover that we hope to make. Will my beating broken and battered beyond consoling? The winds were scattered, and we're fending for nobody but to break. Better keep on breaking it, lover, until it opens. It's a speeding train, beating through the pouring rain, with no way to slow or stop it, and the tracks are broken. The storms we gather, and we're falling on nobody but ourselves. Thank you.
That was Glenn Hansard's Fool's Game, performed live in Nashville. We'll be right back. We're back with more of Bruce's conversation with Glenn Hansard, who breaks down how he wrote the song Fool's Game, the song he just played for us.
Now, was that a song that came out of the same method? Were you in a studio and this it came out of a jam?
Yeah, Matt Dunk was showing me around his vocoder, something I'd never used before, and he had this delay on it, which is like, meow, 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 wow, wow, wow. I was like, it's a fool's game. And I was like, it's a fool's game. And that's all I had. But the way the delay was picking it up, it kind of had this very interesting thing. And I thought, wow, this kind of sound, it sort of reminded me somehow of like a Velvet Underground song, but with a kind of a vocoder. And I thought, this is a very simple chord, you know. Sometimes if you're lucky, you'll hit upon a kind of a song where you go, this sounds simple enough to be really good, you know, where you're not kind of overthinking it. And it just sort of, it's a fool's game, lover that we have to play. And so I just took away the delay and then just sang it. It's a fool's game, lover that we have to play. So it's all the threes, which we were watching an interesting documentary about the bass recently. And the tree is a very important part, the tree over the four. Boom, boom. So one, two. Oh, it's actually, it's a three over three? Right. Yeah. Boom, 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 boom. Apparently this three over the four is like a big thing. I know Dylan's really into it.
We're hearing Queen again over here.
Well, I just picked that example. It could have been something else.
Mm-hmm. Tell me, what that, the three over the four, tell me what that.
Oh, I don't know. I think there was something that was like Bootsy or somebody was talking and it was like, if you're ever in doubt, just give them three. So you just go, you know. So that's the tree that do tree, and then you just fill in something else and give them. Mm-hmm.
Okay, but in that case, like that song, which is a beautiful song, if I asked, I'm sure 100 musicians, they would say no. That song was the product of a songwriter sitting and coming up with a kind of very concise, very perfect lyric that goes with this melody. It doesn't sound like the product of jamming. It doesn't sound like an Eric Clapton song. It doesn't. So yeah. I'm interested in how that came together. Were you playing a certain kind of riff, or and then Romy, you jumped in, or how did that emerge then?
No, there was no guitar involved. It was just a vocoder, keyboard, and a delay. Hmm. And then that became. I actually have the recording here in my phone. Maybe. Well, look, I'd find
play it.
Yeah, I'll find it. It's gonna be. It's called Vocoder Song in my. Let's try this. See if it works. That's me. I haven't hit on the fool's game line yet, but I will. Mm-hmm. That would have been a nice chord. I moved on to something else there, but at some point, I say fool's game, maybe in the next one, but mm-hmm. you hear the idea.
So then in the studio, did you just play that for?
Dunk had forgotten to bring his vocoder with him, which was that sound, which was kind of a culmination of a bunch of stuff going into a bunch of stuff, creating that big sort of fizz of sound and delay. So we went and we ordered some Russian vocoder on eBay, which he claimed would be like the perfect one to do it on. And we, you know, I think we got it for like 600 quid. It was like, it was expensive. Someone in Spain had it, and then Javier, our friend in Spain, had called to the shop, and the guy had given him the, anyway, we got the vocoder. It was a Russian vocoder. We couldn't understand anything that was written on it. It was like, because all the instructions were in Russian, all the buttons. And we tried to get it going and it didn't work. And then we ended up using one of those Korg, the micro Korg, that has a vocoder setting on it, and something that Warren Ellis swears by. He uses it all the time. And so we got this one, and it was perfect. And so, but that was the one we were trying to recreate.
Mm-hmm. And then how did you add, how did you make the song from there? Like, Romy, how did, when you heard it, you thought, did something occur to you about playing it, or?
Well, I think if I remember correctly, we kind of just, like, we set up that microcorg. Mm-hmm. We got a vocoder going, and then, like pretty much everything else, we just sort of, Glenn started singing those lines and playing it, and we all just kind of felt our way around it and got some drone-y stuff going on. But yeah, it was very, very loose.
Mm-hmm. Okay, this is massively putting you on the spot. Could you do that now if Glenn started playing something?
Oh, 100%.
Sure we could.
100%.
Sure
that's the whole session is based on the idea of, here's a thought, you know, like, let me see.
Okay.
Still no word, and I'm waiting. Still no sound. Still no hurt. No hesitating. Be a song in that. Still no word. Still haven't. You know. Still listening. Still waiting. You've not come. Nothing's come back. So suddenly, when you start playing, that you get all these thoughts. Like, okay, so it's still no word is the first thing that fell out of your mouth. Then trust that, and then follow that, and then just use that as a kind of a tent pole to a bunch of thoughts. You know. So what is this? Why is there still no word for who? To who? Why are you waiting? Do you need to wait? Does your life depend on hearing from whoever this is, you know? And then you suddenly your brain just starts going, and then you find just, and you have to allow yourself to go, yeah, blah, blah. That's the key to writing is to allow mistakes, to allow dreadful, like, I mean, we were changing chords. I'm changing chords there without informing anybody what's going on. Mm-hmm. So there's definitely going to be mistakes. We're going to bang into each other, of course, but that's the basis of music.
How long did it take you to be comfortable enough to do that kind of playing? When you were a kid, were you worried about getting it right first and that inhibited you, or were you always able to kind of just open up that way?
No, I don't think we're always able to open up that way. You learn how to play guitar, and of course, when you learn how to play the guitar and any instrument, you want to get it right. So every time you play a song, you want to get it, you want to play it correctly, you want to execute the song correctly. But it does. You do get to a place with musicians where you find intimacy, and that intimacy is that you can completely blow it. I mean, for years, Joe has been listening to me go, you know, and then but when we go on stage, there's a shape to that, and there's there's lyrics to that, but the lyrics don't necessarily come as you as you're beginning. The lyrics can sometimes, you sometimes have to find your way into a song and find your way into what it means. So for instance, when we recorded Fool's Game, I probably had most of the lyric kind of figured out, but I was probably writing that song the whole way through the session, you know, and again, like walking around Paris in between sessions, thinking about the song, listening to the kind of the blah, 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 and the kind of, me trying to find something and kind of going, wow, I really see where I was kind of trying to get to there. But now that I'm outside of that moment where I have the instrument in my hand, I know what I was trying to say. I was trying to say this. And so I write it down.
Okay.
So then I go back and I know exactly what it was I was trying to get.
Well, they're trying to hide the vocoder. That's what I think. Like, keep Glenn away from the vocoder.
He loves that thing. See, anything that takes you out of your comfort, you know, so the vocoder was really great because it takes you away from a guy with a guitar in his hand, because that, you know, I'm limited when it comes to me and a guitar, because I know the chords. I mean, I know the chords, my brain will automatically go to one of those chords because it knows the safety of what that chord will bring. Whereas when you play with something like a vocoder, or even for me, in my case, a piano, like I'll hit a chord where I go, whoa, what's that? And it might actually be the fourth to what I was doing, but because it sounds so different on piano, I'm excited by it. Whereas when I play it on the guitar, I'm not.
So you can, do you say you can almost know your instrument too well?
I think in a way you can get into a rut with your instrument, because you know, once you know how that chord relates to that chord, you get locked into, because, you know, at the end of the day, most Western music operates within a very simple, you know, what is it? The 3-5, it's a Nashville thing, isn't it? The 1-4-5, that idea that once we figure out all of that, then it all becomes second nature. But if you put yourself on an instrument you don't know, you might be doing the 1-4-5, but it sounds amazing because you don't know what you're doing, even though you might still be operating very much in a very simple structure. And that's exciting. I mean, musicians and artists are constantly seeking perspective shifts. That's why when you read, like, you know, Cohen's biography or whatever, you know, you kind of understand why he was taking Mandrax and Speed at the same time, because perspective shift is everything in writing. It's all about getting out of your own head, and literally getting out of your head. I mean, getting out of your own, the place that restricts you to certain ideas. And, you know, there's a lot of romance around musicians' use of drugs, and painters and poets' use of drugs to find themselves in a different headspace, because that's precisely where things can really, you can basically get out of your own way. And that's always what you're looking for. And that's what the vocoder can give you, or what the playing an instrument that you don't know can give you. It gives you a perspective shift, and you can find yourself in a different spot.
Would you like to play another song?
Yeah. When you climb the hill of vision, as above, so it was below, through the apathy and derision, each step ascending you took alone. And when they pin you in the corner, pay no heed to their droning on, 'cause you're not going back where you don't belong. Well, you rose up through the ranks now, and you worked hard for your luck. You've only got yourself to thank now, you and everybody else in the book. And there are hidden hands to guide you, other forces now at play, but you've got to learn to get out of the way. Your own hand,
as the day gives way to night now. May it echo through the land. And when they turn your words against you, try to grind you to the ground. Let them know that they might beat you, but they'll never turn you round.
You take a breath.
Thanks.
What was the experience that led to that song?
I was sitting at the piano in the studio and I was trying to record a song called Shelter Me, a song that, again, didn't make the record. A bunch of the songs that I went in to record didn't make the record. So I was sitting at the piano, I was trying to record the song, and I had this diddly ding dong dong dong. I love that dong dong diddly ding dong 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 dong. There's something about the way that was kind of just flowing, that boom boom. But it reminded me again, like the Stooges or something, like the dong dong dong. You know those, or Great Velvet Underground songs. I keep coming back to them actually, but just that dong 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 dong. You know, when you get that sort of constant piano banging, and because I don't know what I'm doing in terms of the chords, again, I'm feeling quite free. And I remember kind of going, I remember playing the thing, and there is a recording of that too. Let me find it. I'm going to find it for you because it's worth hearing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. This is the very first moment. In fact, I've got this for every single song. The first moment, because that's how the whole record came together. Let me just find it.
I think we need the iPhone memos version of this.
Yeah, it would be interesting to... It would be interesting. Let me see now.
Yeah. Let them know we weren't afraid. There's no heart at least beating. There's no water in the way. Maybe you will have to meet them.
equals one day.
There you go. It's just a, you know, you can just hear it. You can hear the bones of an idea emerging out of it.
There's a touch of Imagine by John Lennon too in the
diggle ding, yeah,
and in the one
yeah, that chord progression, that C, the ba, ba, ba. Yeah, that's the right, that sounds like Imagine.
Good.
You're right.
Yeah, it's kind of nice.
And because I don't know what I'm doing, I don't know. I certainly don't know that I'm referencing John Lennon, but I'm like, oh, that feels like a nice way to get to the next chord. Mm. And so, and it's only where my fingers can reach.
And you've deliberately not learned the piano for that reason. It gives you some.
I honestly have the strong feeling that one must learn an instrument only enough to be able to execute a song. That when you get into the minutia of music, it stops your creativity.
Really.
I feel like I only ever wanted to be a guitar player good enough to play a song. Mm. I never wanted to progress and become a really good lead guitar player or to get into jazz chords, because once you learn the relationship between all the chords, then you've got it mapped. And once you've got it mapped, then you start figuring out interesting paths. And once you find the interesting paths, it's like you know too much. So I love having naivety on an instrument. Like, I love having instruments that I don't know how to play.
Mm. It's interesting. We're in Nashville, which is probably the home of the best players anywhere. We were talking about this earlier. We could get 50 guitarists in here who would be the best in any other city, and they're all right here.
Yeah.
But you like that. You like not knowing things.
For me, it's crucial. Yeah, and it's crucial in the writing process, because the writing process can't be governed by the tuning or the rhythm being right. It has to be. You have to be allowed to just. You know, like, you know, music is not hygiene. It's dirty. It has to be dirty.
When we come back, we'll have more with Glenn Hansard. We're back with Glenn Hansard. Bruce asked him to pick a cover song to play for this taping, and he picked one of my favorites from Joni Mitchell.
We've had people do a lot of covers. This strikes me as the most unusual one. How long have you been playing Coyote?
Oh, well, I learned it. I mean, I know the song for so long. I only learned it when I was invited to play at Joni's 75th or 70th birthday party. I learned it formally, but I always knew it. You know, it's a song that I would kind of play a verse or two. But then sometimes you formally learn a song, as in you sit down and you go, right, I'm gonna learn this. So I've known the song a long time, but I really brushed it up and kind of learned my version, if you like.
Were you a fan of hers?
Oh, God, yeah. Oh, geez, yeah. Since I was, you know, that was the beginning of my musical. My first Joni record was Hijera. I mean, that was the one that I, Court and Spark, they were the records that got me into her. It was only when I was older, I discovered Ladies of the Canyon and the earlier stuff, which was amazing. And Blue, of course. Mm-hmm. But Blue wasn't around when I was a kid. It was more the kind of slightly jazzier stuff. She hadn't gone deep into the jazz thing yet. So Hijera is still a kind of a record that's, you know, fairly accessible. But, no, that was the stuff that I grew up with.
She's a very intimidating person to cover, though. Her music is complicated.
Absolutely. It's deep. I remember having to learn Shadows and, or getting to learn Shadows and Light. And every picture has its shadow, and it has some form of light. blindness, blindness inside. And then it goes to a key change. Treading by all things, God of cruelty, drawn to all things, God of delay. You know, the way her voice is moving around, I had to figure out how to do that. And that was completely outside of my melodic instinct. Mm-hmm. And so it was really difficult. And I was so surprised how the notes just wouldn't go into my head. And then one day it just went bam, and it went into my head, and I had them, and I had it. But it definitely made me a better musician overnight, having to sit down and tackle some of her songs.
Mm-hmm. But this song in particular, which has always been a favorite of mine, is a very tough, unsentimental song with some incredibly memorable lines.
Yeah, it's an amazing song.
But it's
song.
Also very much, it's a woman's song.
Yeah.
Or it's her song.
Absolutely.
Written from the point of view of someone who had this relationship.
Yes.
What's it like to sing it as a man?
Oh, it's wonderful. It's wonderful because, you know, you're just trying to get in, you're trying to get in the headspace where she was at. Mm-hmm. And I love, the masculine and feminine in writing and in music and in life. I find it fascinating to move between both of them and to try to inhabit both equally.
And then you did meet her when you performed this. What was that like?
Yeah, I met her. We shared a dressing room actually, and it was a wonderful experience. She was incredible. She was she gave me such amazing advice. She spent time. She was very present. I mean, it was one of those meetings where I was going, God, I wish I was recording this, because she's speaking so fast and there's so much going on, and her brain is operating at such a high level that I wish I could go often really absorb all this at a later point, but I just had to keep up, and I had a really amazing time.
Do you remember any of the advice she gave you?
I was telling her a story about a homeless guy I know, and I remember her saying, you should rhyme that, you know, and that was, she was like, you should rhyme that song. And I said, that's an amazing way to look at it. She said, well, that's what we do as writers. We just rhyme our lives, you know, just rhyme that story. It's a good one. And so I just thought, what an incredibly, you know, the wisdom of just rhyme it. You know, that's what we do. You know, she, you know, and she, we spoke a little bit about some of the, you know, we were talking about Leonard and we were talking about Dylan, and, you know, and she had very interesting perspectives on these people and Neil Young. And, you know, for me, it was just a very exciting time to, not really stuff I can repeat, you know, because it would just be outside of, I mean, nothing that she probably hasn't said in the press anyway, but, mm-hmm. but it was fascinating to spend time with her and talk about these greats.
But she's the greatest.
Yes, she's incredible. And, you know, she was very straight about that. She was like, I'm as good as any of those motherfuckers. And she's right, you know. I mean, it's like she's absolutely, she's giant. And I just really thank whatever good fortune and good, you know, alignment of stars or whatever it was that put me in a room with her for those couple of days. And just to have been around, you know, whenever you're in the presence of mastery, everything changes, the air changes. And so it's a wonderful feeling to be so close to somebody who really has gone deep, so deep.
Well, get us a little closer.
All right. We haven't played this together before, so we'll just kind of wing it.
No regrets, Coyote. We just come from such different sets of circumstances. I'm up all night in the studios and you're up early on your ranch. You'll be brushing out the broom's tail while the sun is ascending, and I'll just be getting home with my reel-to-reel. There's no comprehending. Just so close to the bone and the skin and the eyes and the lips she can get, and still feel so alone. I still feel related, like stations in some relay. You're not a hit and run driver, no. Pacing away. You just picked up a hitcher, a prisoner of the white lines on the freeway. A farmhouse burning down in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of the night. We rode right past that tragedy and stopped into some roadhouse lights where a local band was playing. Locals were up kicking and a shaking on the floor. Next thing I know, The coyote's at my door. He pins me in the corner and he won't take no. Drags me out on the dance floor and we're dancing close and slow. Now he's got a woman at home. He's got another woman down the hallway and he seems to want me anyway. Why'd you have to get so drunk and leave me on that way? You just picked up a hitcher, a prisoner of the white lines on the freeway. I looked the coyote right in the face. On the road to Belgian in my old hometown, he went running through the whisker weeds, chasing some prize down, and a hawk was playing with him. Coyote was jumping right up and making passes. He had those same eyes just like yours, under your dark glasses. Privately probing the public rooms, peeking through keyholes and numbered doors, where the players lit their wounds and take their temporary lovers and pills and powders to get them through this passion play. No regrets, coyote, I'll just get off up a ways. You just picked up a hitcher, a prisoner of the white lines on the freeway. Coyote's in the coffee shop, staring a hole in his scrambled eggs. He picks up my scent on his fingers while he's watching the waitress's legs. He's too far from the Bay of Fundy, from Appaloosas and Eagles and Tides, in their conditioned cubicles and the carbon ribbon rights. They're spelling it out so clear. Either you're gonna have to stand and fight or take off out of here. I tried to run away myself, to run away and wrestle with my ego. And this plane you put here in this Eskimo, in this prisoner, in this hitcher, the white line, of the white line, of the white line on the freeway.
Did we get that? Was it all right?
Was it all right?
Yeah, I think we got it. Yeah. Okay, great.
I think it was all right.
Okay, good.
Glenn Hansard's album, The Wild Willing, is available now, so be sure to go check it out. You can head to brokenrecordpodcast.com to check out a playlist we put together for this episode, including his new album and the great Queen song that he sampled. Broken Record is produced with help from Jason Gambrell, Mia Lobel, and Leah Rose. Our theme music's by Kenny Beats. I'm Justin Richmond. Thanks for listening.